And the first thing she does is drop all her papers. There we go. Now, I need to turn this on, James, don't I? Can you hear me? Is that okay? Good. It's a wonderful symbol, isn't it, for a VUCA world. You arrive and you just drop everything. Here it is. Like Liz was saying, I never thought that I'd be preparing this talk right in the middle of it. It was a tremendous exercise in how one manages one's anxiety at, what do you say, what do you leave out? How do you navigate the sense that we're, don't know where we're going, but wherever we're going very fast. And it's an honor to be here today to address you. Thank you, Liz, for inviting me. It's also rather daunting, given the levels of expertise and experience in the room. I know that there are some tremendous thought leaders and coaching pioneers here. Coaching is quite a young, still quite a young profession. And it's rather daunting in the light of current events, because we're in the meaning-making business, are we not, as coaches? And to try to be doing that in the middle of an ever-changing and fluid environment is particularly challenging, I think. And one of the themes, we'll get to the green tree a little bit later, but one of the themes is how do we maintain our capacity to think and our capacity to maintain an equilibrium, if you like, in an ever-moving environment. So, volatile. Sudden, increasing velocity, reversals, and things that kick off escalate very, very quickly. Uncertainty also encompasses unpredictability. We cannot any longer maintain our unconscious sense that the future is going to be in some way a version of the past. The picture at the bottom is Scarra Brae. It's the Neolithic site in Orkney. Some of you will have visited it. When it was built, it was quite a long way from the sea. They never thought that at some point they will be overtaken by the sea. And it's certainly in the balance whether it will be saved. At some point, environment will overtake the buildings. We're uncertain about our own futures, jobs, homes, our children's futures. But there's also a new level of uncertainty, I think, and the environmental implications there say it, about the future of human well-being on this planet. The planet will probably survive without us. Certainly the bugs will, but our own uncertain future. And even so-called or stable institutions can feel very, very wobbly. We've witnessed over the last decade a number of seismic shocks to many of the great institutions, education, government, the religious institutions, that have profoundly rocked people's faith in having reference points. I work quite a bit in Ireland, and the undermining of the fabric, if you like, of a great deal of Irish society with the scandals that rocked the Irish Church over a period of time can be felt in the sense of what do we believe in now? Where are our reference points? Where are the rocks? Complexity certainly can feel and look like that. It's not a synonym for complicated. What we've got to remember with complexity is that things are entangled and entwined. I saw one commentator coin the phrase intertwangled, which I rather liked. I thought we could adopt that. You will know I'm a great fan of languages. What Liz didn't say was that I studied languages at university, and I love the way language influences how we think and how we are. words we use. Very important, and I'll be talking more about metaphor in a little while. Are you going to keep time for me, Liz, so that I don't just ramble on forever? Is someone going to do that, or shall I? They're going to hold up great signs. I've got my angel at the back who's looking after me. That's terrific. Thank you, Maggie. And with a complex environment, what you get is this knock-on effect, and you get it very, very quickly. So chaos is not just a theory, it's what it feels like. We know that decisions and actions taken here will have an impact right across the globe. And we're right in the middle of that, right? You know, one decision, which some people apparently took quite lightly, to leave the European Union. We're seeing the tremendous, not just ripples, makes it sound rather nice, ripples, doesn't it? Rather gentle. We're seeing the seismic shocks everywhere to the markets and to people's beliefs and thinking, actually, about the UK and about the sense of what the European Union is all about. And it also speaks to our networked world. I wonder what you see when you look at this picture, just to involve you a little bit more. I chose this for ambiguity. It's a picture I took myself in Turkey. While you're looking, I'll take a sip of water. It's clearly a room of some kind, with some cakes and sandwiches laid out. What else do you see? Anybody want to risk shouting out? Google, well done. When people look at it close up, and I've done this little experiment, they can't see it. It's quite interesting. And the ambiguity of it, we were there for a good couple of hours before the boss of Google Turkey had to point this out to us, that it had been very cleverly designed. And I think the ambiguity extends to our feelings, probably, about the company. On the one hand, it's the most popular and respected search engine. On the other hand, there are all sorts of complexities around its managing of people's private data and so on. This ambiguity permeates many of our big organizations today. I was working with a head of HR in a large oil and gas company recently. We were developing a program with him. And right up until, you know, several months in, he had no idea that a colleague of his in another part of the organization was developing something similar without actually connecting with him. So ripe for miscommunication, misapprehension, misunderstandings, a tremendous sense of there's something going on out there, but I'm not sure what it is, and I certainly am not involved. And this, all of these things speak to our survival mechanisms. We want to be included. Exclusion, you know, our wiring is still pretty much that of the African savannah, and exclusion meant death, exclusion from the tribe way back. So those feelings of not being part of something can feel incredibly threatening. Issues of status and power are triggered by a VUCA world, and it can feel a bit like this. Probably relate to that, or even this. And this is in Brazil, or even this. And I think, you know, regardless of your rational and your thinking and the debates you've been having, if like me you've been involved in lots of sort of lively discussions over the last, avidly reading the news and so on, our feelings will often tell us something different about this. So I want to talk a little bit about, just to put some pointers in the room. I think it's a fantastic that we're all here today to have a chance, really, to talk about, to air, to listen to each other about what is it like, what are your experiences, what are our experiences of working and coaching in a VUCA world. So I just want to really put some markers, some way markers, into the debate for us to pick up during the day. Then it's going to be a very rich day of tools, techniques, approaches, opportunities to find ways of working with a VUCA world. So I want to give some just top-level thoughts about what I see as the impact. I've got a book coming out next year called Coaching Comes of Age, and when I was writing it, I was actually, the first two essays in the book are all about the VUCA world and what I see as a new generation of coaches have been developing over the, I've been researching it over the last couple of years, 2.5 years, and seeing this new generation of coaches developing a different ways of dealing with the VUCA world. But let's just look for a moment at what the impact is on us. We live in the world, we're part of it. I think that we have to be careful not to conflate anxiety with fear. Fear has a known object. Anxiety is much, much harder, paradoxically, to tolerate than fear. And I'm going to give a little taxonomy, a little sort of pick apart, get a bit granular about anxiety, because I think it's quite useful. Because what we do in our when we feel that we can't tolerate the levels of anxiety is we create something to be afraid of. When it's out there, it's much easier to deal with. So what we've seen, for example, with Brexit, a very tangible, immediate example, is the levels of anxiety and the levels of feelings of exclusion and feeling disrespected over decades, actually, this has been in the making, have fixated on the issue of immigration. It's an absolute perfect proxy for our wired, hardwired stranger danger wiring. And we have to be careful, I think, as coaches, to not buy into the object of fear. We're trained as coaches. You know, coaching has grown up with a wonderful panoply of tools, techniques, approaches, structures, models, four-box models, pyramid models, and so on and so on. It's a very rich and often very precise and elegant toolkit that we have to choose from. But we mustn't get... The temptation when you have a wonderful toolkit is you want to use it. I know that sounds paradoxical, and we should continue to use these wonderful tools. But I think we want to be careful not to fixate on the problem out there. So let me just say a very quick word about anxiety. I think there are broadly four different types of anxiety. The first one is existential. Like all creatures, we're born with a survival mechanism. We know that our survival depends absolutely on our caregivers. The human animal is far more vulnerable than most, and our dependency, the period of our dependency, is far greater, is much more extended than in other creatures. And that existential anxiety gets triggered constantly in a VUCA world. Feelings of exclusion, oops, that wasn't meant to happen. I've pressed the wrong thing. No? What do I do now, James? Okay, fast forward. It's gone back to the beginning. Sorry about that, guys. Don't put a tool in my hand. Clearly misused. That existential anxiety gets triggered all the time in VUCA situations. The second form of anxiety is linked with that. Because our period of dependency is extended, the human animal's period of dependency is extended, we develop quite ambivalent feelings about it. Those of you who've got toddlers will know that push-pull, I want to do it myself, and then when it doesn't work, you know, come running back, help me, and those feelings of dependency continue throughout and into the workplace. And they underpin our ambivalence about wanting to be part of a team, wanting to belong, wanting to share, wanting to collaborate, which we're also wired to do because our survival depends also on that, but also that thing of wanting to be separate, wanting to assert our individuality. And the third area is less well talked about. The third area comes from our wired desire to know. We're meaning-making creatures. Why is one of the first questions our children ask. Why is this? Why that? Why the other? And our desire for knowledge is part of how we become human. It's part of how we make meaning in our lives. And we have to learn from experience. It's a psychic imperative. Our psychological and emotional health depends on our capacity to turn our sense experience into some form of meaning, into memories, into understanding, and into a sense, a framework of how we see our world in the mind. But there's equally a drive to not know, to turn away from, to turn a blind eye. This gets very, this is very sharply highlighted. I worked for 9 months in a hospice with the senior nursing team there. And there were as many people there who did not want to know the stage of their disease. There were as many families who did not want to know as there were those who wanted to know. So that drive to turn away from is very strong in us. And I think that in a VUCA world where meaning is very difficult to pin down, the level of anxiety that provokes, do I want to know, do I not want to know, how do I get to know, what does knowledge mean, is exacerbated and a further source of anxiety. The fourth form is not talked about much. It's begun to be explored increasingly in the neuroscience circles, but it's not talked so much about in coaching world, is the outside coming inside. When I had a very personal example of this when the Paris bombings were happening. My daughter was right there, just around the corner. And by sheer good fortune, she'd been in that bar the night before, so she wasn't there that particular Friday evening. She was just around the corner watching events happening on her laptop in real time, because there were journalists there who were filming on their mobile phones. And we were in London, in contact, on our mobile phones, saying what's happening, how's it going, are you all right, and so on and so on. This thing of terror entering our homes, as it did when televisions first arrived, and then now into our handheld devices, is a very new form of anxiety. On the one hand, we can say it knocks down walls, we can talk and make friends with people right across the globe, and be compassionate and have care about what's happening in Syria and so on. On the other hand, we're not actually wired to have that level of continuous and pervasive terror, if you like, those sort of real-time fears right inside ourselves, because we are porous human beings. We are porous and we are absorbent. And I think that we don't yet know what the long-term impact is going to be. But there's a social psychologist called George Lakoff who writes extensively about metaphors, and probably some of you are familiar with his concept of frames, that it's the metaphors that create the frames that give us our sense of meaning. And what fits the frame, we accept, and what doesn't, we don't. And he's written extensively about the Democratic and the Republican use of completely different frames, which is why they can't talk to each other. And he writes about metaphors of terror to explain the profound impact on the American psyche of the Twin Towers, the destruction of the Twin Towers in 9/11. And this intimate participation is very new. And what he talks about is that our systems of metaphorical thought, we think in metaphors, which is an embodied process, interact with our mirror neurons in a way that actually external literal horrors become internal metaphorical horrors. And I think that we mustn't dismiss the pervasive presence of this in our clients' lives. I saw a client only yesterday, and I was profoundly struck at how twitchy he was. someone who is normally and very much considered a rock in his organisation and normally very positive. He was saying all the right words, lots of good stuff has been happening, but his level of alert was quite extraordinary. And he had his wasn't a laptop, you know, a small
tablet,
thank you. The word escaped me. I've got a friend here who's going to help me with that when I forget the word. It's like that, you know, press the buzzer and call a friend. He had his tablet open with emails pinging. I had to actually ask him. He's never done that before. And I had to actually ask him. I said, you know, should we close the tablet so we can actually be present here? And I was really struck at how exacerbated, how heightened all of that is. One reaction is to try and take back control. How many times have you heard, we will take back control over the last couple of weeks? It's a bit like trying to sort of stop a flood. You can't actually stop a flood. What you can try and do is build bitter channels for the water to run down, but to try and hold back a flood, it's like, you know, putting your finger in the dike. It isn't going to work. But this desire to take back control is an absolute knee-jerk desire. What can we control? And what you see in organisations is more and more structures, more and more measures. I worked in a bank once, and during one of the crashes, and they upped the amount of reporting from twice a day to four times a day. So nobody could really do any work at all because they were constantly reporting the figures. You know, and this was somehow fix things. And when we stand back and think about it, it's absurd, isn't it? But that desire to retake control. And another reaction you will see is a resurgence of authoritarianism. This notion that the strong man will save us, and it usually is a strong man. Although, quite interestingly, but let's not go there, we might see some interesting demographic changes in our political theatre, the halls of power. But this concept that somebody up there has the answer. You probably unconsciously had all sorts of expectations of today. You know, coming here, someone up there is going to have some answers for me. What do I do? I wish I did. But authoritarianism is another reaction. We close down. Curiosity closes down. Follow the rules. Do it like you always did. It'll be all right. And stress literally inhabits us. I think I've talked about that. But this concept of porosity, this concept of being porous, is talked about by architects quite a lot. Because when cities really work well, they are porous. We can inhabit them, we can move through them. We can be alone, we can be together in small groups, we can be in large groups. We have a sense of air and space and life and vitality. We're just the same. But in a 24/7 non-stop digitalized world, what happens to us? How does it inhabit us? And this term perverse organizations, just turning to the collective, has been used in the past. I forget where it actually comes from. I have got it down there somewhere. But I learned about it through Professor of Management Susan Long from Australia. And she defines perverse organizations as, well, the dictionary defines perverse organizations as showing a deliberate and obstinate desire to behave in a way that is unreasonable or unacceptable. And Susan Long's studies, research, and then her book came out of her study of what happened with Enron. And we could add Bering and Northern Rock and so on and so on. We could add a whole bunch of them. And she locates corruption at the heart of the perverse state of mind. I think we should change that and call it perverse cultures, because I think we're seeing, you know, that one of the themes of the Brexit vote, which I thought was so interesting, was how many people afterwards said, oh, I wish I hadn't voted that way. I only did it to sort of make a statement, whichever way it was, and whatever, you know, your beliefs about our future are. And that perversity, it's almost like a magical thinking. And Susan Long locates corruption at the heart of the perverse state of mind and says that there are five elements. It's when we put individual good before the collective good, when there's a denial of reality, so that incapacity to see what's actually going on. And there's a wonderful reading of the Oedipus myth that I commend to you, if you don't know it, by John Steiner. It's quite old now. It's as startling and rich now as it was then. He focuses not on Oedipus, but on how come nobody knew he was there? How come nobody called out? You know, his mother, who he married, you know, knew he had a wounded ankle because her husband had wounded his ankles. I'm not going to go into the Oedipus myth, but it's a very interesting study of turning a blind eye. And as you know, Oedipus blinds himself because reality is too hard to contain. It's too hard, his, you know, to contain the damage that has been done. So the denial of reality, it's another element, the third element, is having instrumental relations. When people start to become cogs in a wheel, and we know all about that as coaches, we know all about people who start to feel that actually they're not treated as human beings, they're just being treated as part of the system, interchangeable, move about. And that's, I mean, I work in a lot of global organisations all over the world, and that feeling is very strong right now. The fourth element is you engage others in the groupthink. You know, that quality of groupthink that develops. No, it's not like we've got our own little sort of gang mentality that builds up. And that sense of complicity or self-deception starts to become institutionalised. When I talk about corruption, I don't necessarily just mean financial corruption. If I go back to the hospice, just a very short little anecdote will, I think, describe what I'm talking about. The hospice was initially set up under a spiritual aegis umbrella by a group of nuns, and it was very much in that mould of enabling people to die with dignity and solace and to be there for them and to help them and support them. As it entered the NHS, I was there during this transition when the nuns left the hospice and the hospice was taken over by the NHS. They shifted from a spiritual model to a medical model. And a lot more doctors used to come and do their internship or, you know, part of their elective as medics on the wards in this hospice. And they brought with them all the authority of doctors. As we know, surgeons are next down from God, and then after that you've got, and so on. But doctors really carry enormous authority. And the medical model is all about healing people, getting them well. So you had this clash of models in the hospice, which was very, very hard to take. We're back to our VUCA acronym here. It was an ambiguous situation. Nurses began to feel not just disempowered, but disrespected. And actually, what are we here for? They felt they weren't able to do the job that they'd signed up for. They felt distressed and frustrated, but also somehow a little bit helpless and disempowered. One day, the senior head nurse of one of the wards asked one of the junior nurses to take care of the wards just for 20 minutes while she went to a meeting. And this was a male nurse, and he said, "Oh, you're not going to be long, are you? You know, please don't be long, and give me all the details." And he held her up for a good 5 minutes while she went through all the details of who was what and where on the ward. And he said, his passing shot as she left the ward, he said, "Because I don't want anybody to die on my watch." And she had to turn around and stop and say, "Look, this is a hospice. That's what people have come here to do." So that perverse denial of reality creates the kinds of cultures. And I think we have to ask ourselves, it's one of the things that I would invite today, is for us to look at what are the limits of coaching and how do we, many of us work in perverse organisations, how do we both reinforce ourselves and how do we cope with perverse organisations? What is coaching for in a VUCA world? This is one of my favourite quotations. Raymond Williams was an English professor at Cambridge. And I love it for its radicalism, being a radical at heart. And I think that right now, this is not a bad motto for coaching. What if, so to be truly radical is to make hope possible rather than despair convincing. And I think the stakes are quite high at the moment. So what if we didn't see this, but we saw this instead? These are the Pantanal wetlands in Brazil. a very beautiful forest that for 6 months of the year has water two-thirds the way up those tree trunks. So those trees, this forest has adapted to live in a very unstable environment with all its complexity and beauty. What if we saw the shifting, fluid, mysterious ecology of the forest and were able to carry that with us instead of the sense of entangled chaos? What if we learned to love complexity instead of finding ways to simplify it, control it, classify it, box it in, tidy it up, and lock it down? And I think that's one of the challenges for us as coaching comes of age. We've had approximately, depending on where you locate the beginning, I tend to locate the beginning of coaching as a profession with Tim Galway's development of the inner game of tennis, which is roughly about 40 years ago now, 35, 40 years ago. And I think we're moving from a sort of juvenile young adult phase into the beginning of a maturity for coaching as a profession. We've had this tremendous development of technique and tools, as I mentioned earlier. We've also had this very necessary and really fantastic assiduous research strand that runs through coaching. And these will continue. One of the things that I'm trained as a psychotherapist, and I worked in private practice for quite a long time. And one of the things that made me stop working as a psychotherapist and start working as a coach, there were two things. One was that I think context matters. And since we spend an enormous amount of our time at work, I wanted to see what it was like and see how people can function well at work and actually flourish. So that was the context. I wanted to shift the context from this notion of the safe space that psychotherapists occupy into the much more fluid and perhaps dangerous space of the workplace. The other thing that I loved about coaching was its non-pathologizing remit. And I think this is an enormous privilege that we have as coaches, is that we have access to those, to leaders who are in power. This is a privilege that I think we don't either fully acknowledge, fully accept, and perhaps step up in terms of our responsibility to that. And coaching sort of sits at the delta, if you like, of a whole range of confluences, and it's this rich diversity that makes it so resilient. I would maintain that in a VUCA world, coaching has the potential to become not only more important, more necessary for leaders out there trying to navigate what we've already seen, this let's hardly call it a territory, this kind of fluid space, the flow. But also it's an enormous question mark, if you like, for how will coaches step up into that responsibility. And I think that there, what I'm seeing, I think many have and do. This, as I said, this is a room full of thought leaders, pioneers of coaching, and those who are already embracing what I've called new generation coaching. And I think it's going to become even more imperative as we go forward. VUCA is not about to settle down into anything remotely resembling stability. And I think there are four qualities, if you like, or four dimensions to it. We talk a lot about partnership, but partnership actually means a partnership of equals. And I think that what I see in coaches who truly partner with leaders in the corridors of power, running large organizations, is this sense of commitment and a sense of collaboration. It's actually accepting that coaches are actors in the world, not observers or superb technicians. It is about moving on from being a superb technician and becoming a true actor. And for this to work, if I jump to secular spirituality, we need to know what our values are. We need to know what we stand for and how, what our worldview is, What is our shape? We take these things so much for granted that we don't often sit down and say, do you know, what actually am I here for? What's my purpose in the world? And I think that given the global challenges that we're facing, and we've talked about a VUCA world, but before we were dumped in the middle of a VUCA world, we're already living in one. We know what the impact of increasing climate change. We now have a window of about a decade before we will reach that tipping point when we have a 50-50 chance of reaching that two degrees centigrade dangerous level. In the last 40 years, about half of the mammals, all the big species, have declined just in 40 years since the 1970s. These are big ticket issues. Human beings aren't faring that much better. A study by Relate, which I thought was very interesting, about friendship and about how people, did people have friends at work? 1 in 10 people say they don't have a close friend. I could go on. Given these global challenges, I don't think it's tenable any longer for coaching to position itself as the sort of Switzerland of the helping professions. You know, I'm not sure neutral was ever an option, but it certainly isn't now. So finding out what our own values and meanings are, and I'll say a bit more about values in a moment, having this systemic and also integral mindset. So one question I always ask my clients is, what's your contribution to the problems you're talking about? How have you helped cause the problems, wittingly or unwittingly? What's the bigger picture here? We know about things like that. Coaches who have this sort of mindset are much more comfortable with complexity and have a far greater understanding of the interdependence that we need to cultivate to help people accept and value their dependence in a world that actually valorizes independence. It's very difficult to feel okay about our dependency when all around us we're told we need to be independent. Those of you who know, there are all the measures that we use, the MBTI, the EQI, and so on and so on and so on. There's always some sort of question about independence, and I work a lot in Asia, and I have to spend a lot of time explaining that and explaining why, no, it doesn't mean you have to make every decision on your own without consulting your colleagues. So those sort of talking around those things. I think partnership also means accepting that one of the tenets, one of the sort of value tenets of coaching is that we mustn't foster dependency. We must only do short-term, short interventions, you know, the 6-session contract and so on. Maybe we need to rethink that. Maybe we need to think about what would it be like to partner with some of our leaders long-term, perhaps not every month. I mean, I have clients who I see perhaps every 3 months or 4 months. It's their chance to tap in, to step back, and to dive deep. So I think this raises quite a lot of questions for us as we go forward. And particularly this thing about what is coaching's contribution to the global challenges that we face. I don't think that there's room any longer for passengers on the bus. Let's see if this will move forward. At this point, I'd like to do something a little bit unorthodox, since we're used to that as coaches. And I've talked about my time in Brazil, visiting the Pantanal. And when I was there, I became very, very aware, very conscious of how, as I stepped into the forest started to inhabit me. And it was one of the stimulus for the title of this talk, Keep a Green Tree in Your Heart. And I think that we've talked about how stress inhabits us. Nature, human beings, our minds, our hearts abhor a vacuum. We fill it with something. And I think one of the things that we as coaches need to reflect on is how do we help our clients, our leaders, inhabit different places and have different metaphors inhabit them. So I'd like to invite us to do a little embodiment exercise. And you can do this eyes open, or eyes closed. I'm debating whether I'll get you to stand up. I think I will, because I think there's going to be a lot of sitting today. So why don't we all stand up and put papers and pens down? And you may not want to close your eyes. It can make one feel a bit wobbly when you're standing. But if you are comfortable closing your eyes, please do. Otherwise, just suggest you just lower your gaze. And just take a few deep breaths. And as you breathe, I suggest you have this sense of the breath traveling up your spine. This is the treat bit of the talk. This is the bit where you get to focus on self-care. Very necessary to nourish the prefrontal cortex. Thinking is an embodied experience. So as you breathe in, up your spine, feel the air expand your spine, and as you breathe out, gently breathe out down the front of your body and just relax the front of your body. It's where we hold tension in our belly or our chest, our shoulders, our lower back. So enjoy this breathing experience of going up your spine and experience your spine extending, elongating, and then as you breathe out, it goes down the front of your body. Just relaxing. That's not a collapse, it's not a softening, it's just a relaxing, a nourishing. And as you breathe up your spine, feel your spine growing like the trunk of a tree. It's strong, it's flexible, it reaches up towards the sky. This is your sense of dignity as you breathe up. And as you soften and you breathe down, you're breathing down the front of the trunk of the tree, welcoming, softening, receiving. And as you breathe down, have this sense of your roots going down into the ground. This is your integrity. This is your contact. These are your roots. And now as you breathe in, feel that sense of expanding in your chest. Because the tree now is growing its green foliage. And your whole chest is expanding to include this beautiful, bright, vivid green. There's air, there's vitality, there's life. And know that you, as this tree, are host to a whole range of other life. That it's a vital, living, dynamic system. You are a vital, living, dynamic system. Feel the sky above, the earth below, that sense of expansion, a sense of flexible strength, and a softening, receptive, opening to connection, opening to contribution through the front of your body. And slowly bring yourself back to the room and open your eyes if you've closed them, and I invite you to take your seats again. Sheer curiosity. I'd love to know just a couple of words from the audience. What impact? What was the effect on you? It might be nothing. It might be anything.
Bigger.
Feel bigger?
Relaxing.
Relaxing? That's good. It's always good. We could do with that. Calming. Centered. Okay. Terribly, terribly simple. But how many of us do that with our clients? I could have done this yesterday with my client and something stopped me. His energy in wanting to talk about everything and anything was hard to get in, and I know we'll be doing more mindfulness today during the day. This goes back, the other stimulus for this exercise goes back to when I was at infant school, and we were invited, I remember vividly, we were invited to be a tree. And I will never forget the pleasure of becoming a tree. So moving on, what other ways do we invite that expansiveness, that sense of biggerness, and that sense of being able to hold on to our dignity and our integrity, reach out to make connection, and also reach out to contribution? And I just want to name check two people who I know, one of them, I can see one of them in the room, colleagues of mine, Liz Rivers and Paul King, who you should collar them and ask them about leadership embodiment, because that tree exercise is a conflation of the work of Wendy Palmer, very, very simple, very powerful embodiment exercises that engages both our capacity to be strong, our testosterone, in a useful and effective way, and also our capacity to reach out, our oxytocin, to reach out and connect with others in a way that helps us, through practice, override some of those trigger survival mechanisms. The tree is also a metaphor. We need to be thinking of new metaphors. A very, very quick story, and I know that I'm running out of time. Fascinating study in a town in the States where they took groups of people. One group, they said, there's a crime wave coming through the city, and like a virus, they used plague, illness, viral metaphors. With the other group, they used wild beast metaphors. The crime wave is rampaging through the city. Language is associative. There was a whole range around it. And they talked about that. And those who had been fed the viral plague metaphors proposed healing, curative, preventative methods with crime. Those that had imbibed the rampaging beast metaphors proposed very punitive and methods to deal with it. Knowing what we stand for, very important. Positive drivers for change, I won't go into detail here, but the synergies and interactions between what millennials want, and there's tons of studies. What's more interesting to me is how similar they are to what women have been asking for from the workplace for a long time. By sheer numbers, millennials are looked to set to change. They're predicted to be about 75% of our workforce by about 2020. Sheer force of numbers. If we don't learn how to work with and coach millennials, we will not remain relevant. Likewise, women are acceding to leadership positions very, very fast. They have different ways of leading. And what we're calling now third actors, the baby boomers, are not lying down and retiring. And as you know, the pension crisis won't let them anyway. How do we re-engage them? What is their contribution? And what are the synergies that we can see? And there are other drivers for change that I won't go into. Business also is a driver for change. I was in a meeting the other day with Vodafone. They are now making a massive business case for dealing with energy. They're facing a 1.1 billion per annum energy costs as demand for data increases. People don't know that the emissions from data centers is comparable to that of the aviation industry. These are the factors. This is what we're seeing with leading edge businesses. A capacity to repair based on the acknowledgement of the harm done, a capacity to regenerate, a cradle to cradle model. More of a taste for risk, so a more piloting mentality. Rather than think short-termism, we're thinking piloting, and then what about for the long term? What does it mean? And resilience is very much thinking towards the long term, bouncing forwards. And what we call positive deviance are one of the best ways to deal with perverse organisations. And I have a lovely story about a positive deviant. You'll have to collar me in the break for that. This is what we're seeing. I think leadership embodiment, finding a way to be vulnerable, to be unfixed, to be centered and attentive, based on our values, based on seeking understanding, but not being fixed about knowing. It's a paradox that we have to navigate. Creativity and awareness. And I'm just going to go through these as visuals rather than talk to them. What do we care for? And also, are we able to care for those who are really radically different to us? But it's also, what do we care about? Passion is one of the most overused words today. I rather like to substitute caring about. The psychotherapist David Smale said that care, what you care about, is actually a political, it's about political engagement. It enables us to be players in the public forum. That's Rosa Parks, by the way. And she enabled, Rosa sat so that Mark could stand so that Obama could run. You've heard that before, but it's a nice one anyway. Compassion in the heat of battle. Are we able to maintain radical compassion even when things are kicking off all around us? And compassion for the world. Again, this is a stand, not a nice to have. Very, very difficult to feel compassionate for your board of directors, for example, if they're consistently undermining you. And finally, the big one I think we need to reframe is courage. These are the white helmets who go into the bombed buildings in Syria. They're ordinary men and women with ordinary jobs. They put a white helmet on and they form the Syrian Civil Guard. They're saving lives on a daily basis. Courage could look like this or like this. But it can also look like this, taking a stand, being silent, or even like this. Courage can be as much about endurance, about not acting, and the capacity to sit still as it can be about acting. And I think these are some of the values we need to explore, examine, reframe for ourselves and our clients in a VUCA world. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Hetty. That was really fascinating. Sorry to cut you off. I could have gone on listening for ages. Can we move very quickly? Sorry, very little gesture of our appreciation.
Oh, bless you. Thank you.
Very quickly to wherever you're going, which is, if you're going to the News UK KED study, it's in the Diploma Suite, straight upstairs, so out to where you came in. If you're doing mindful, compassionate coaching with me, it's in the Turner Room, which is here, and next door for Eve Turner and Peter Hawkins' session on multi-stakeholder contracting. So, yes, if you could move quickly, we'll try and catch up some time because we started slightly late.